Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Chronicles. He left off in this chapter 5, and we've been dealing with the Solomon's Temple and all of its dimensions and all the articles and everything that it was involved in the making of this temple. It took 7 years. It became one of the seven wonders of the world. It was just absolutely magnificent. But the thing about that temple that always intrigued me is that it wasn't that large of a structure. I mean, obviously, compared to our superstructures today, you know, skyscrapers and whatnot, it just wasn't. It wasn't much bigger than this house here. But the worth of that temple was just beyond measure because it was paneled all on the inside of gold. And, you know, there's so much that went into it in terms of just the expense of it all and the making of it all, because they quarried these stones, and some of these stones, and they just weighed tons, but they were all quarried a great distance away, and everyone fit in just exactly the way it was supposed to fit. They didn't ever use a hammer or chisel or saw or grinder or anything like that on the temple site. So you can see the type of precision and just the incredible time, money, energy, and effort that went into making this temple. And I would just throw this out here, too, because even though we're reading about Solomon's temple, Peter makes it abundantly clear, and so does Paul, that we are temples of the Holy Spirit, and that there's a spiritual temple being built up, and we are all living stones within this temple. And I think that we really need to keep that in mind. In other words, I think, and I've said this so many times over the years, but every single one of us has a job to do in building this temple. Every single one of us. God has given us gifts. He's given us resources. He's given us talents. He's given us abilities. He's given us all kinds of things. And even people that don't have anything, they can always pray. Pray for the salvation of souls, the edification of Christ's church, and for, you know, our family members, this type of thing. This is all having to do with building up God's temple. And when we're reading this, like I said, I think that if people could really see the importance of it, that it's a privilege, it's an honor, it's a glory to be able to serve Christ. I believe there's going to be a lot of people, and they very well could be saved in the end, that aren't going to have a whole lot to show for what they've done for God. Mm-hmm. All right? I mean, like the thief on the cross. I mean, you know, he just stole heaven in a sense. You know, he got in right under the wire. He made that deathbed conversion. But as far as rewards, he spent his life basically in opposition to God as far as his moral laws. I mean, a thief and an insurrectionist and whatever else he, you know, he was doing. But I do think that people, if they have spent their life working on this temple for God, they're not going to regret it on their deathbed, believe me. Mm-hmm. They're going to see that this was a great honor and a great privilege. So when we're reading about this temple, don't have the mindset that, well, this was way back, almost 900 years before Christ or 800 years before Christ. No, this has a lot of relevance for us today. Now, there's no way I'm going to try to get through two chapters tonight, because this we're going to be dealing with the dedication of this temple. But chapter 6, you know, it's like something like 42 verses, if I'm not mistaken. Wow. Yeah, 42 verses. And this one's only 14, but I don't want to try to do them both together, even though it's still dealing with the dedication of this temple, because I think it's way too much to try to bite off. But beginning with this verse 1 of chapter 5 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "Thus all the work that Solomon performed for the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold and all the utensils, and put them in the treasuries of the house of God. Then Solomon assembled to Jerusalem the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes and the leaders of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel to bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. All the men of Israel assembled themselves to the king at the feast, that is, in the seventh month. Then all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark, and they brought up the ark and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the Levitical priests brought them up. And Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priest brought up the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place into the inner sanctuary of the house, to the holy of holies under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim had spread their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim made a covering over the ark and its poles. The poles were so long that the ends of the poles of the ark could be seen in front of the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside, and they are there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except two tablets, which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Now, I just wanted to read that far down before we go any further. And just go back and break it down, because I do think it says a lot in what's being recorded here. Because it said this in verse 1, "Thus all the work of Solomon performed in the house of the Lord was finished." And I just throw this out here because it was Jesus who said in the Gospels, he said, you know, that night is coming when no man can work. And he said, "I must work the works of him who sent me while it's still day." Put it this way, like I was saying, prefacing this chapter here, it's like we all have a job to do. Mm-hmm. We really do. We have a job to do. And I myself, personally, I would like to have an epitaph like the Apostle Paul. He says that I have fought the good fight. I have kept the faith. I have finished the race. Mm-hmm. He finished it. You see, and then we're talking about here how Solomon says that he finished the house of the Lord. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it took 7 years, but he had thousands of people working on this virtually around the clock, right? And I would say this, there's a lot of things that I think that we have to do, but I think if we just keep procrastinating and just keep putting it off and just keep making excuses or whatever it is, we may not finish what God has set out for us to do. I know in the book of Revelation, there was one of the churches that he chided them. He says, "I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God." And I would say this, it's far better to start one thing and see it all the way through and finish it than start half a dozen things and never finish what you start, right? I think Jesus himself made that clear when he was challenging people when it came to, you know, being his followers. He said, you know, you got to count the cost. He says, you know, you can't be like a person who starts to build this superstructure and then halfway through discovers he doesn't have enough resources, enough money, enough anything to try to finish what he started, because he's just going to look like a complete fool. So when it says here that Solomon, thus all the work that Solomon performed for the house of the Lord was finished. And two, just keep this in mind. When people don't do what God has assigned them to do, other people will either have to take up the slack or it just doesn't get done. Mm-hmm. Paul tells us, as well as it's in Proverbs, it says, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it mightily as unto the Lord." And I do think that Jesus finds half-heartedness, lukewarmness, you know, mediocrity. He finds it nauseating. He does. That's what he said to the church of Laodicea, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it says here, still with that first 1 of chapter 5 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "And Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold and all utensils, and put them in the treasuries of the house of God." And there were so many things that were donated to this temple by David. And then David, I guess he was able to stir up a lot of the leaders of Israel. So there was this incredible wealth that was donated to, you know, the treasury of this temple, as well as all the utensils. I don't care whether it's the plates and the pans and all of the things that they were used in the service of the temple. But the sad thing is, I think he's listing all these things, or he's itemizing these things that we went into the temple, but where's the last time we really read about them?
When
Belshazzar was having that big drunken bash, and you decide, well, you know, that's when all these things were confiscated and they were just warehoused, and then Belshazzar decided he would just bring them all in to this big drunken feast, and then begin to drink out of these cups and these bowls, stuff like that. And he wasn't short on cups or plates or anything else. He just went out of his way to blaspheme the God of heaven. And that's when that hand came out and wrote on the wall, "Meeny, meeny, take all parson, meeny, your days are numbered. Your days are numbered." Look at so many people today that just go out of their way, I think, to just insult God. They go out of their way. And one of the things that Paul lists as far as people who are not going to make it to heaven are revilers. Well, I would say this. These hardcore atheists that are out there leading the charge in terms of mocking Christ, Christianity, the Bible, religion, these are revilers. You're not an atheist at all. What you are is a God hater. Because God has put the knowledge of himself in your heart. You know, so you're just lying to yourself and everybody else, all right? I'd have far more respect for you to come out and just simply say, yeah, there's a God, but he can go to hell as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to do what I do my own thing. You know, I'll stand up and salute a person like that. I'm not kidding you. But these people who claim to be atheists and they're hiding behind, quote-unquote, reason, or they're more intelligent or more superior than anybody else, that's a joke. That's the biggest stinking joke. I mean, these guys are just fools. That's what they are. And I don't want to get off on a soapbox here, but I'm just talking about people today who just go out of their way to insult God.
Oh, yeah.
They're all over the place, and they're coming out of the woodwork, but they have a judgment for them coming. Just like this Belshazzar, he went out of his way to insult God. But then what happened? That hand comes out and writes on the wall, meeny, meeny, take over. In other words, your days are numbered. Yeah. And he died that night. He was killed that night, and his kingdom was divided. That, to me, I think is a dark warning to anybody, because we're going to be weighing the balances. It doesn't mean that God is going to weigh all our good deeds against all our bad deeds. Don't get that idea at all. But we are going to be weighing the balances in terms of where we are, in terms of our faith, in terms of living it out, in terms of our commitment. And then he says in that verse 2, then Solomon assembled to Jerusalem the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel, to bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And Zion is Jerusalem. It's just another name for Jerusalem. They're bringing up this ark into Jerusalem. But it says a lot in terms of Solomon, in terms of his leadership. I mean, he's galvanizing these people and rallying them and getting them all to honor God, to glorify God. And I would say this, I'm a stickler on this. I really believe that leadership makes all the difference in the world in terms of whether people have some good leaders spiritually, or even politically. It's going to really determine the destiny of a lot of people, right? I'm just saying this. Look at Solomon. This is the type of leader that he was, at least at the beginning of his reign. He gets all of these people motivated to do what? To bring up this ark and to dedicate this temple and to really glorify God, right? And that says a lot to me in regards to leaders, or good leaders, or what makes a good leader. And I think that you can see it in Solomon. Unfortunately for him, at the end of his days, he wasn't the leader that he used to be here. But you get a good leader, he can really motivate, he can really challenge, he can really inspire. And look at so many politicians today. How many politicians do we have today who really would say to themselves, you know what, doesn't matter if I get elected, doesn't matter if I get reelected, I'm going to do what's best for this country? How many politicians can you think of off the top of your head are like that? I cannot think of one. I don't care what party it is. I cannot think of one. Now, does that make a good leader? That doesn't make a good leader at all. And in my opinion, one of the greatest leaders of all time was Moses. And what made him such a great leader, in my opinion, is this. First of all, God calls him to be this leader, and he doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
He's making one excuse after another, after another, after another. In other words, look at the leadership today. Look at these politicians today. They will do anything. They will say anything. They will cut their own mother's throat to get elected. And look at even these guys that have gone down in flames with their sexual scandals. They're all jumping back on the bandwagon and getting into the political fray again, because that means more to them than anything. And I'm just simply saying, they make the worst leaders, the worst leaders. The best ones usually are the ones who are reluctant to lead. But then Moses begins his leadership. But what's interesting to me is this. When God picked out 70 other leaders that he was going to help Moses with, all right, and he puts his spirit on these 70 leaders, well, when Joshua found out that they were prophesying, Joshua said to Moses, hey, tell them to shut up, man. And Moses said, are you jealous for my sake that you want to refrain them from speaking out? He says, I wish that all of God's people, I wish this whole stinking assembly would prophesy. In other words, would have the Spirit of God put on them, because he wasn't concerned about his position,
right,
and his authority or his power. I think that that's what made him such a great leader, right? And I'm talking about Solomon, how he was able to galvanize these people to really honor God in this. And he says this in verse 3 of 2 Chronicles chapter 5. All the men of Israel assembled themselves to the king at the feast, that is, in the seventh month. Then all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark, and they brought up the ark and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent. The Levitical priesthood brought them up. And now here's the thing I think was very important. Solomon's father David, when he wanted to bring up the ark into Jerusalem, he made a really bad mistake, and somebody was killed because of it. Anybody remember that story? What happened there?
wasn't the Levites that were carrying it? Is that right?
In other words, they took that Ark of the Covenant, and it says they put it on a new cart. Yeah. And being pulled by oxen, right? And God made it so clear that it was to be the priest to carry the holy objects, especially the Ark of the Covenant, that they were to carry it. It had the poles in it. There was to be four priests, one on each side, to carry it, and not like a coffin down on their side, but up on their shoulders, symbolizing what? That they are uplifting God, and they are uplifting Him and His holiness, and He's doing the guiding, He's doing the directing, right?
Yeah.
That's the way they were to carry that ark. But what happened in the time of David when he was trying to bring it up there, that one of the oxen stumbled, and then Uzzah reached out to steady the ark, and he was struck dead. And then David got angry. He got angry. He thought, why would God do this? But keep this in mind, all right? In that situation, would you say that David was sincere?
Yep.
Yeah.
Would you say that he really wanted to honor God?
Yeah.
Now, I always say this. There's a lot of people today who feel like it doesn't matter what you do, what you believe, or how you act. All you need to do is be sincere. Mm. Now, that seems to be, I think, the order of the day with a lot of people. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you heard that before?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just be sincere. Well,
no matter what you believe.
Yeah, see, that has nothing to do with being obedient to God, right? And even David had to learn that the hard way, because the whole procession stopped, and then as a result, David said, well, we can't bring this in. You know, we can't go any further. So they took the ark and they put it into a guy's house named Obed-Edom. And it was there for 3 months, and David heard that God is really blessing this man, blessing his household. And David thought, man, we got to get this ark back here. You know? Mm-hmm. So obviously, David went to the priest and said, hey, what did we do wrong? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to bring it in, and now they're going to do it right. Now the priest is going to carry it, and then they went six paces and they sacrificed to God, and then another six paces and they sacrificed to God. And by the time they got that ark into Jerusalem, David was just dancing, and he was totally ecstatic, all right? Dancing for joy before the Lord. See, if we do things God's way, we're going to be a much happier people, right?
Yeah, John, he was sincere, and I don't think he even meant to do that, but and he's like a lot of people. God says, it's my way. I want you to honor me by doing it, you know, not man's way, not the way you think it should be, but I want you to do it my way. And he, in his human frailty, forgot that.
Yeah.
And God had to remind him again.
And in many respects, there was no excuse, because you had these two guys, Ohio and Uzzah, they were brothers, and apparently they also were priests. And these guys should have known better. Should have known better. But they didn't do it God's way. And I think it's a dark warning to all of us. You know what I'm saying? Sincerity has nothing to do with whether a person goes to heaven or hell. I mean, it's really, are we going to be obedient to God? He said, do it this way. He said, well, no, I don't want to do it this way. I want to do it my way. And that's exactly what David did, even though his intention was good. So when we're reading here in that verse 4 and 5, I think it's significant, because it's then all the elders of Israel came and the Levites took up the ark. In other words, they didn't throw it on any cart, right? And they brought up the ark and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the Levitical priesthood brought them up. All of these things were brought up by the priest the way they were supposed to be. And then verse 6, it says, and King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. And this is what at the dedication of the temple, right? Mm-hmm. And all of these sacrifices are going up to God. And I think it just says a lot, because you know the whole nation is really enthused about this. And that's why there's so many to sacrifice. And we'll read, I think, in the following chapter that they have so many sacrifices that Solomon has to basically select more places to sacrifice them in that court area, because the altar couldn't hold them all. But all these sacrifices pointed to Jesus Christ, one way, shape, or form, or the other. And that altar, you know, it pointed to the cross of Christ. And it says in verse 6, and Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing so many sheep and oxen they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priest brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, to the holy of holies under the wings of the cherubim. Now, in Solomon's temple, when he brought it into the holy of holies, they had these two cherubim that were standing before that that veil. All right, and these cherubim, their wingspan was 15 feet. each, and so their wings were touching. So we're talking about it went from wall to wall. But these cherubim, what were they really symbolizing spiritually?
Holiness of God.
God's holiness. Why? Why do you say that?
They were the first ones mentioned. They guard the tree of life.
Yeah. In other words, God sent a cherubim. A cherubim is an angel with two wings, but he had a flaming sword, and he was to guard the tree of life, that these Adam and Eve could no longer eat from this tree because they were now under this curse. All right? So these angels uphold God's holiness, and they proclaim his judgment if we're not going to uphold his holiness. But these angels are just massive, and they're overlaid, you know, the whole thing was overlaid, or the whole inside was paneled with gold, and they had all kinds of cherubim that were on the walls inside. And these two cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant, they had their wings touching each other. All right, and they were looking down at what?
The mercy seat.
And what was put on the mercy seat?
The blood.
That's where they sprinkled the blood.
Okay.
That, and they were looking down at the blood. All right. And the fact that there's two of them, they got to be, everything's going to be established on two or three witnesses. And the fact that their wings are touching, you know, shows that they're in agreement. They're in agreement with God. And then I'll get into what's inside the ark, because what's inside the ark is all important, because that's where we break God's moral laws, or, you know, that's where we sin against him, right? That's why that blood went on that mercy seat. But look what also it says here. I think it's kind of interesting. In verse 9, we'll start with that verse 8 again. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim made a covering over the ark and its poles. All right, now it's talking about the Ark of the Covenant. I was just mentioning these cherubim. And it says this in verse 9. The poles were so long that the ends of the poles of the ark could be seen in front of the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside, and they are there to this day. There's nothing in the ark. Okay, now, there's another interesting thing about the ark. We read this, of course, way back in the book of Exodus, but in Exodus chapter 25, it says this about those poles and about the ark. It says this: you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be removed from it. Now, here's the thing. You got that ark there, and we're even mentioning here the poles of this ark. All right, and it's saying that the poles were so long that you could see them from the inside of the sanctuary, but you couldn't see them from the outside. And my point is this. Why were those poles left in that ark? Why was God insistent upon that?
Ready anytime.
Yeah, good, because the poles were used for transportation, right? And here's the thing. Those poles needed to be in that ark 24/7, never to be taken out. The only time they did take them out was when they wrapped up the ark with the veil and with the porpoise skins, and then they put those poles back in, all right, just to wrap it up. But those poles remained in there, showing this. We have to be ready at a moment's notice to do what?
Whenever the Spirit prompts.
Yeah. Whenever God says, okay, it's time to move out, we've got to be ready to move out. In other words, let's just say they took the poles out of there, and then, of course, they were going through the desert at the time, but let's just say a few months later they were to move out, and then they can't find the poles. They misplaced the poles, or they can't find one of them, or whatever. You know, that says something to me in terms of we always got to be ready. I mean, what does it say in Hebrews chapter 3? It says this: take care, brethren, that there be not in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sins. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast to the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While it is said today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as they provoked me back in the wilderness. It's today. Now is acceptable time, like in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And working together with him, with God, we also urge you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, or God says, at the acceptable time I listen to you, and on the day of salvation I help you. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. And this is so many other verses that you could make that application, that, you know what? When God's speaking to us, it's time to move out. I mean, it's time. We need to respond. We need to respond to his call, to his direction, to whatever he's telling us to do, right? I think that those That's what those poles speak of, right? When he's talking about that, I mean, we could read this and it just feel like, well, this is just a lot of useless information, but I think it has an application to where we are today. What those poles really meant is that when God says it's time to move out, you know, then it's time to go, right? But now, here's what's interesting. Look at this first tent. There was nothing in the ark except two tablets which Moses put there at Horeb. That's at Mount Sinai, okay, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of Egypt. But what's missing now?
The staff and the manna.
Because we know from Hebrews chapter 9, and also in other portions of Scripture, but it says this in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4. Well, I'll start with verse 3. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense, and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod, which budded, and the tablets of the covenant. In other words, the Ten Commandments. Now, what's missing when we read this? Look over here in the Second Chronicles chapter 5, verse 10. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets, or the Ten Commandments, right, which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of Egypt.
Where's the manna? Where's the staff?
Where's the manna? Where's Aaron's rod? Now,
yeah.
We don't know for sure, but can anybody take an educated guess based on Scripture? Okay, I would say that there's two possibilities here, because if you go back to Samuel, that's a situation where, if you recall, that God judged the people of Israel because they got out of his will and they were doing all kinds of things to just really provoke him to anger, and that's when they were defeated by the Philistines in battle, and that's when the Philistines got a hold of that ark and they captured it in battle, and then they brought it in and they placed that ark in front of their god Dagon. Remember that story now? In 1 Samuel? All right. What happened to their god Dagon?
Fell down.
It says this, that they put the Ark of the Covenant in front of their god Dagon, and apparently this Dagon, he was half man, half fish. He had the torso at the bottom of a fish, all right, and the upper torso of a man, and this was their god, all right, Dagon. And they put the Ark of the Covenant in front of him, in front of this the statue that they had there, and then the priests go in there the next morning. That statue had fallen down. Mm-hmm. And so they thought, well, we got to prop this back up. So they put it back up. And then the next night, this thing had fallen down, and it busted the hands, and they went rolling and resting in front of the threshold of their temple to get in. And so the priest, because they figured, well, this is Dagon's hands, that's sacred. So from that day forward, they jump over the threshold where his hands lie. But then, what happened to the Philistines when they had this ark to the people, to the cities?
They
broke out with tumors, with sores, and they had an infestation of mice. And they were just plagued. And every time they tried to move this ark to a different city, the people were just plagued. And they were dying from these different things. And it took them 7 months to finally get it to put it together, because they basically inquired of their priests and their cultic prognosticators or fortune tellers or whatever. And they said, well, this is because of the ark, right? That we're under all this judgment. So they put this thing on a new cart, and it had two cows who had just given birth. Right, and they put these cows, basically harnessed them to this cart, and they said, "Well, let's see what happens. Where do these cows go? Because what would be the natural inclination of these cows?"
Toward a young.
Yeah, they would naturally not want to leave their young, but they put these two mother cows who had just given birth. They harnessed them to this cart, and then the cart went towards Israel.
Right.
And these cows were lowing or mooing all the way, showing that they really didn't want to go.
Yep.
But God was driving them over there. But this is what it says, okay, in regards to what happened to that ark, because it says this. Let me just read. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 6. It says, "These are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ascalon, one for Gath, and one for the Ekron." In other words, they made images of these of the tumors as well as mice, and they put them there as a kind of a sacrifice. I guess they put them on the cart going back to Israel, right? And then it says this, and the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both of fortified cities and the country villages. The large stone on which they set the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua the Bethshemite. He, this is God, struck down some of the men of Bethshema because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down all the people, 50,000, 70 men, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. Now here's the thing. There's two possibilities of what had happened to, you know, Aaron's rod and the jar of manna. All right, is that the Philistines could have taken it, or the people who are looking into the ark, they could have confiscated it, and then God sent this tremendous judgment upon them. But when we get over here and we're reading about the dedication of this temple, it says there's only one thing in the ark, and that's the Ten Commandments. But I think even that is significant. Keep something in mind here. That ark is actually pointing to Jesus Christ. All right, it's made of acacia wood. And what does the wood point to?
It's
humanness. All right, it's coming out as a tree that comes out of the ground. In other words, he's from the earth. Okay, but the gold points to his deity. It's overlaid with gold. It shows his two natures. Right, and inside it points to Christ as being our law giver and our law keeper, and also our God's final authority, and the bread from heaven, the manna that comes down from heaven. But here's the thing. Everything now is tied up in Jesus Christ. Faith in Jesus Christ is what's going to save us. And all the ceremonial laws, I don't care whether it's dietary laws, I don't care whether it's the cleansing laws, or what you could, the days you worship on, all these different feast days, they all had its fulfillment in Christ. So we're no longer bound by the ceremonial laws. But what are we still bound by today?
God's word.
Mm-hmm. Moral laws.
God's moral laws. They're still intact. Even in the New Testament, they're still intact. Mm-hmm. You can't say, well, I put my faith in Jesus Christ, so I'm saved. It doesn't matter if I'm living in this adulterous affair or not. I'm going to heaven. What doesn't matter is, if you want to have ham and eggs for breakfast, that's fine, because it had its fulfillment in Christ, right? The ceremonial laws were not bound by, but the fact that his moral laws are still intact. Now, I'm going to see if anybody could tell me, all right, what happened when the Babylonians came down centuries later and the temple was destroyed. Everything was burnt and torn down and destroyed. What happened to the ark? Anybody have any idea?
It doesn't say.
The Bible doesn't say, but I think what's kind of interesting is this. All right? What's that?
And it ended up in Harrison Ford's
house. Oh, yeah. The Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay. There we go. There's a Bible scholar over there. Yeah. But here's what's interesting. This is a Catholic Bible. Okay. But you can also find it in the Greek Orthodox Bible and the various other versions of Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox, I believe, and also they have different translations like the Jerusalem Bible, the Douay Virgin Bible, the Latin Vulgate. They have some books in there that have been left out of my Protestant Bible, but I think it's well worth reading. And one of the books is called Second Maccabees, but this is what it says. And Jeremiah was the one, okay, who was basically the prophet down there in Jerusalem when Jerusalem was overrun. But just before Jerusalem gets overrun by the Babylonians as a judgment from God and the temple is destroyed, it says this in Second Maccabees chapter 2. It's talking about Jeremiah. And he says, with other similar words, he, this is Jeremiah, urged them, those are the people, not to let the law depart from their hearts. The same document also tells how the prophet, this is Jeremiah, following a divine revelation, in other words, this is what God told him to do, ordered that the tent of the ark should accompany him, and how he went off to the mountain which Moses climbed to see God's inheritance. Now, what mountain was that? Anybody remember?
Ararat?
No, not Ararat. That's the Ark of Noah's Ark rested on there. I'm talking about... What mountain did Moses climb to look over into Promised Land before he died?
Mount Nebo.
The reason I want people to remember that, all right, because this is what it says. All right, he went up to the mountain which Moses climbed to see God's inheritance. You read that in Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 32. When Jeremiah arrived there, he found a room in a cave in which he put the tent, the ark, and the altar of incense. Then he blocked up the entrance. Some of those who followed him came up intending to mark the path, but they could not find it. When Jeremiah heard of this, he reproved them, and saying, this place is to remain unknown until God gathers his people together again and shows them mercy. Then the Lord will disclose these things, and the glory of the Lord will be seen in the cloud, just as it appeared in the time of Moses, and when Solomon prayed that the place might be gloriously sanctified. And we're going to be reading about that, because that's what Solomon's going to do here as far as the dedication. But what's interesting to me is this. God told Jeremiah, take the ark, take the altar of incense, take these holy things. I want you to take it up to Mount Nebo and hide them in a cave. And then he hid all these things in a cave just before Jerusalem was overrun and the temple destroyed. And when he hid it, okay, they covered up the cave and I guess put all kinds of things in front of it. Then some of the people that helped him went back to map it out. Mm-hmm. Map it out. Where is it at? Make a map. And they couldn't find it. And when Jeremiah found out about that, he reproved him. He got in their face. He says, you're not supposed to be doing that. He says, that thing is not going to be found again until God reveals himself to his people. And I get this impression. That could mean one of two things. That ark is going to be found, and it's going to be the, I guess, the final impetus or catalyst to get their temple up. Yeah. All right. However, if it's not that, then it means it's going to be found after Christ returns and sets up his millennial temple.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not sure which one it's going to apply to. I would almost suggest, well, it may be just the millennial temple. And the reason I say that is because this temple that they're going to erect is the tribulation temple, and that's going to be totally defiled. How?
Antichrist.
Yeah. The Antichrist is going to go in there. So there's a likelihood that, you know, it may be just found when Christ returns and sets up his millennial temple. And that's neither here nor there. You know, you could take it or leave it. I personally believe that that's what happened to that ark. All right. People have said for many years, what happened to that ark? And this ark is someday going to be found again.
But God's hidden it.
Nobody's going to find it until God's ready. Now, I'm just going to wind this down because I only got a few verses to go. When it says in verse 11, when the priest came forth from the holy place, for all the priests who were present had sanctified themselves without regard to divisions. In other words, how many divisions did you have a priest? Three. All right. You had the Kohathites, you had the Gershomites, and you had the Merarites. All right. These were the three sons of Levi, and they divided them up into divisions in terms of their jobs and their responsibilities. Anybody know what the Kohathites' responsibilities happened to be? They were the ones that carried the most holy articles. Would you say that's a privilege that they had?
Yeah.
But interesting thing, you go book and read the book of Numbers, there was a guy there by the name of Korah, and he was actually Moses' cousin, and he was a Kohathite. He had the responsibility, the job of carrying this ark, but that wasn't good enough for him. He said he wanted to be a priest too. He wanted to be like Aaron. He said all God's people are holy. He stirred up this whole revolt, and he said that the 250 guys took a censer. They weren't priests, and they were going to offer the censer this holy incense to God. What happened to these 250 guys?
God opened up the earth.
Well, the 250 guys, I said the fire came out from the Lord and consumed these 250 guys. But then, Korah, Dathan, and Abram, it says that God opened up the earth and them, their possessions, and their family went headlong down into the grave. And the earth closed up over them. But I think it's kind of interesting. This guy had a really, really, I think, privileged job. And I think it's a dark warning to any of us and all of us, you know, that whatever position God has given us in the church, I mean, we need to really excel in what he's given us to do. Not become envious or covetous or resentful or bitter that somebody else has a position that we would like. I would love to have gifts that I don't have. I'm telling you, I really would. But I'm not going to bemoan the fact that I don't have these certain gifts. All right? I say, okay, I'll just develop the gift that God has given me, right? Because that's what Paul says. Stir up, he told that to Timothy, stir up the gift that's in you. You've got to work at your gift and work at it and develop it and, you know, really mature in your gift rather than looking around like, well, I've been given a crummy hand here, to hell with this, and, you know, get all ticked off about it. Say, no, whatever you have, it could be absolutely blessed and sanctified and multiplied by God if we're willing to just glorify what little bit we have. Look at Dorcas. What was her gift? Otherwise known as Tabitha. What was her gift?
Sewing.
She had one gift. It was a needle and thread. She could sew like the wind. And she sewed all these items, these cloaks, these trousers, all these different things for all the poor, the needy, the widow, the orphan. And, you know, she's the only grown woman mm-hmm. mentioned in Scripture that was raised from the dead. That's how God honored her. But she could have said, whoa, sewing, what's that? The heck with this, man. I want to be in charge. I want to be lead. No, she used that little gift, right? Right, and God honored her, and she was the only grown woman in Scripture that was raised from the dead. And I think it was that's how God was pleased with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about these priests. Well, look what happened to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. They stirred up all this assembly, and they got all... But look at the job that they had. When they were going into Jericho, they had to cross the Jordan, right? Interesting thing. It was the priests carrying the ark. They were the first ones to step into the Jordan, but as soon as they took a step to go into the Jordan, what happened? The water receded. How far up did it recede?
In front of
us. It's set up by Adam, which was 25 miles up the road from where they stepped in. It was during the harvest season when the Jordan was overflowing its banks, and that water was backed up 25 miles up the road. But these were the priests that were carrying this ark, and the whole assembly, all right, we're talking maybe 5 million people. They had to stay about a half a mile away from the ark, back further from the ark. But when these priests took the first step and then they go into the Jordan, they were the first ones in, but they were the last ones out.
Yeah.
Why?
Everybody had to get across.
Yeah.
They had to stand in the middle of the Jordan holding this ark while everybody else passed over. All right, millions of people passing over. Now, what does that tell us? And put it this way. What if you were a priest standing there holding that ark? What would be your feeling? What would you be thinking?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But that's a certain
amount. Why keep trying to let him
go? Yeah. Wouldn't you, if you're standing there in the middle of the Jordan, that's the place of death. Why do I say it's the place of death?
Somebody does something wrong, God gets mad, the water's coming.
There it is. In other words, you're the first one in. You really want to be the first one out, too. But no, you stand there with God while everybody passes over. Now, they're passing into the Promised Land. What does the Promised Land symbolize? Heaven. Heaven, right? So, this is what God's leaders have to do today. They have to stand with God in a place of death so that other people can pass over. In other words, the place of death, you got to die to yourself, all right? Mm-hmm. You can't do what you want to do. You got to stand there and elevate God, honor God, stand there with God. He's with us in that place of death, right? Like what I'm doing right now, in a sense. I'm not trying to, you know, torture or anything, but I got to stand in this place of death if other people are going to pass over. Now, it's going to require me to do what? To be poured out like a drink offering. This is costly. But sure, I want to get out of here. You know, I'd love to get out of here, right? Just go to heaven, heck, with this battle and all. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But no, that's where you gotta stay if you're going to be effective for God, right? Mm-hmm. So when it's talking about these divisions of the priests, and then you had the Gershonites, they were the ones that took care of all the curtains, all right, that went around the tabernacle and inside the tabernacle and all around the court of the tabernacle. That was their job. And then you had the Merarites; they were the ones to take up all the sockets and the pillars. That was their job to transport all these things. So it's talking about the divisions of the priests. You had three different divisions, but I would say this, just to make an application, because look at verse 11, for all the priests who were present had sanctified themselves without regard to the divisions. Now, I want to paraphrase this. So all the ministers of God had to sanctify themselves without regard to denomination. You see the application? I don't care what denomination you're at. If you are in the pulpit, if you are a pastor, minister, priest, evangelist, whatever, you got to sanctify yourself, meaning what? You can't have people in the pulpit who are living in sin and being out there proclaiming God's word. I mean, you've got to sanctify yourself regardless of your denomination. It says in verse 12, it says, and all the Levitical singers, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, and their sons and kinsmen, clothed in fine linen with the cymbals and harps and lyres, and standing east of the altar, with them 120 priests blowing the trumpets. Mm-hmm. In unison, when the trumpeters and the singers were to make themselves heard, and one voice to praise praise and to glorify the Lord. And when they lifted up their voice, accompanied by trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music, and when they praised the Lord, saying, He indeed is good, for His loving kindness is everlasting, then the house of the Lord was filled with the cloud, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of God. Now, interesting thing. When they have this permanent structure, then obviously they don't need the divisions of the priests to do the carrying. They don't need the division of the priests to, you know, take down the curtains and put them up in the sockets and the boards. But how do they now divide up the priests?
Musically?
Yeah, musically. They had rotations where they would be the singers and they would be the musicians and they would be the ones to lead the people in worship, okay? They still had a job, they still had a function to do, right? But interesting thing, one of the things that they were doing was blowing trumpets. And this is, to me, the job of a priest. Now, remember in a situation with Jericho? I think it says a lot when we went to the book of Joshua. When they were going to, Jericho was going to be the first city that God was going to have destroyed. It said this, and it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horn before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priest who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while they continually blew the trumpets. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what God had told these people. I don't want one peep out of anybody, but you go and you march around Jericho one time with the ark. The only noise I want to hear is these trumpets being blown. There were seven priests that, blowing the trumpets. Seven is the number of totality, completeness, perfection, right? They were to be blowing the trumpets. Now, why would God have them do that?
It'd be
God doing it, not them doing it.
Well, put it this way, okay? You're blowing the trumpets. You go around the city one time. The priests are the only ones, okay, blowing the trumpets, seven of them. And they blew it continually all the way around. Then they went back to camp. Did it the second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day. On the seventh day, they go around seven times blowing a trumpet. And then when they come around the seventh time, they complete that lap. Then everybody gives a shout at that long blast of a trumpet, and then the walls come down. But here's the thing. Those trumpets, when they were going around, it was almost like God saying, warning, 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 warning. Oh. All right? He's giving the warning. But who's blowing the trumpets? Mm-hmm. It's the priest. Now, how many people in the pulpit today are blowing the trumpet? Saying, warning, 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 warning. We got a lot of flute players out there in the pulpit. I mean, they're just Pied Pipers, and they're just, you know, just a lot of religious fluff. But how many people are blowing the trumpet? You see, and I really feel like there's not too many blowing the trumpet, saying warning, warning, warning. Because it was God's way of saying warning, and people could still be saved in Jericho. How?
Yeah. Oh, by getting a house where the harlot...
Yeah, it was Rahab, the prostitute. They told her, you put a scarlet thread out your window. That scarlet thread pointed to what?
No, they couldn't have.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, I guess they could have, because you said you, your family, and anyone else.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. The invitation was anyone in your household, anybody you wanted, you get them into that house. But they have to stay there. That's the condition. Right. Let's just say she had a house full of people, and then the first day goes by, the second day goes by, the third day. Oh, this is ridiculous! I'm getting out of here. They leave the house. Right? It's the same thing like the Passover, having the blood on the door. First, could be there and say, "Well, I don't want to be here. Heck, I want to go outside and see what's going on." Well, now you're not under the blood, but the warning was being the trumpets. It's almost like anybody who believed me, just go to Rahab's house and you can be saved. Same thing today. We're not hearing the trumpets being blown, but who's supposed to be blowing them? It's supposed to be the priest. But I'm telling you right now, God's blowing the trumpets. Mm-hmm. How is God blowing the trumpets?
With the natural disasters.
Yeah. You just look around. You know what it says in the book? Yeah. You know what it says in the book of Amos? Just before God destroyed the northern kingdom, you know, by the Assyrians. In the book of Amos, it says this: "But I gave you cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and lack of bread in all your places, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord." Right. This is a judgment that God put upon his people. In other words, this is a trumpet. What does he mean by, I gave you cleanness of teeth?
Well,
What's that mean?
A lot of dentists.
Huh? What's that?
A lot of food.
Nothing to dirty your teeth.
In other words, you didn't need a toothpick because you didn't have anything between your teeth because he really sent rationing scarcity as far as their food. But they didn't return to him. Then he said this, furthermore, I withheld rain from you while there was still 3 months until harvest. Then I would send rain on one city, and on another city I would not send rain, and one part it would be rained on, while the other part not rained on would dry up. So two or three cities would stagger to another city to drink water, but would not be satisfied. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. Look at this country. Part of the country is experiencing severe drought. Other parts are flooding. You know what I'm saying? That's a trumpet warning, right? He goes on to say, I smote you with scorching wind and mildew, and the caterpillar was devouring your many gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. Look what's happening to our economy. And now everything's being, you know, eaten up, right? He says, I sent a plague among you after the manner of Egypt. I slew your young men by the sword along with your captured horses, and I made the stench of your camp rise up in your nostrils, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. In other words, look what happened in Vietnam. That was our first military defeat. Look what happened to us in Afghanistan and in Iraq. This is a no-win situation. But did anybody realize that's a trumpet warning from God? Yet we're not returning to Him. All right, we're up to our eyeballs in one war after another, and we're not returning to God. Right? And I think what's also kind of interesting is this is what it says in Amos. Chapter 5, it just says this. It says, for I know your transgressions are many and your sins are great, you who distress the righteous and accept bribes and turn aside the poor and the gate. Therefore, at such a time, the prudent person keeps silent, for it is evil time. In other words, I'm talking about the blowing of the trumpets and how the priests had this responsibility and how so many the people in the pulpit, they're not blowing up a trumpet. Right? And so it's an evil time where the prudent person just keeps quiet. They're not going to say anything because they know
they're
just
quiet, but they get shut down.
Oh, they're going to get fired.
Huge cries.
Well, look at I'll throw this out before we close. Look what happened to so many people who were in the health industry who came out and said the obvious. They said the obvious. Look, this whole scourge of HIV and AIDS, this is preventable. This is caused by behavior. Mm-hmm. People who came out and said such a thing, they got fired. They were forced to resign. But the prudent person who knows this is a result of this behavior, right? They're going to keep their mouth shut. See, that was where we are at today. That's where it was in the time of Amos, before the destruction of the northern tribes. And what I'm talking about now, the priests need to blow the trumpet. Mm-hmm. But they're just flute players, right? And just concluding thought here, because it does say here that what happened there was that when they put the ark in there, then the glory of the Lord came to that temple in such a way, and it filled it in such a way, I get the impression that smoke was billowing out of that temple, and it was so blinding, nobody could go into there. That's exactly what happened when the tabernacle was dedicated. God's presence just filled that tabernacle. Not even Moses could go in there, right? And anybody tell me when that's going to happen again? Only it's going to be in heaven, the temple.
Millennial? Huh?
No, not the millennial period. But in the millennial period, we're not told that in Ezekiel, but that's probably what will
happen. Something about a pillar of cloud and something.
Yeah. Well, I'm pointing to this. You read in the book of Revelation, there's a temple in heaven.
Yeah.
And when God is going to pour out the seven last bowls or judgments or plagues or vials upon the earth because of man's wickedness, it says that these seven angels come out of the temple of God, and then they go forth to pour out their bowls, and it says that smoke just billows out of the temple, and nobody can get into the temple until these are poured out. In other words, here God's glory, His presence is being manifested through this overwhelming brightness or glory. But in heaven, it's going to be a time of judgment, where nobody can go into the temple of God until His wrath is complete. And I think it says a lot, because, you know, if we're not going to accept what He has done for us through Jesus Christ, then there's coming that time when it's going to be a terrible thing for people, when they're no longer going to even be able to, their prayers are not going to reach heaven.
Right.
They can't get into the temple because God's mercy is now exhausted, and people's destinies are now fixed. And that, you know, anybody have anyone to add or share?
Mm-hmm.